Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, welcome to Revolution Radio. And I'm going to welcome our callers on this evening in just a second. As you know, this show is really dedicated to being a place where patriots can come together to bring our country back and restore constitutional governance. And John F. Kennedy, in his inaugural address, said, "Those who make revolution, peaceful revolution, impossible will make violent revolution inevitable." So we're dedicated to peaceful revolution, and tonight we're going to be talking about the Articles of Freedom, and I'm now going to welcome our guest this evening, Area 360, you're on the line. Who are we speaking with?
You're talking to Red Beckman.
Red Beckman, thank you very much for joining us this evening. And Area 512.
John Rowland.
John, welcome, delegate from Texas. And 111.
That's probably Skype. That would be me, Terry Dodd in Colorado.
Hi, Skype. I mean, Terry Dodd, how are you? Thank you all for joining us this evening. And I first wanted to mention I extended the show for another half hour, so we're at 2 hours tonight, because last time we really were just getting going when the show started. So we expect Jeff Williams tonight, hopefully Ed Vallejo, and so forth. So this evening, first to announce that the Articles of Freedom are almost done and almost out. I know we keep saying that, but they're in a place right now, I think, that we can at least talk about them and see what we have. The document is called the Articles of Freedom, the Works of the Continental Congress. It is for the free people of the United States of America. There are a number of sections to it. We have, I believe, 15 articles, I think, 15 articles. And tonight I'd like to talk about actually four things and invite all of our guests to do this in whatever order we would like to and just sort of have a free-flowing discussion. But the first articles I'd like to talk about are the Sovereignty and the Declaration of Independence, Article 1. And the article we worked on, Article 4, Militia, the Firearms, and the Second Amendment. I believe those two things are related from both the national perspective as well as what we the people need to do on the ground with the states and so forth and so on. And then the second piece that I'd like to focus on tonight, after about the first 45 minutes, I guess, is to look at, I believe it's Article 9, Foreign Policy and the General Welfare Clause, and Article 12, War Powers, and Articles 1 and 2 of the Constitution, because, again, those two things are related, and I think we can figure out at least some ways to discuss this tonight to, you know, apprise our listeners of not only what we did, and but some of the actions that we came out with. So does that sound agreeable to you, gentlemen, on the line?
Must be agreeable.
Okay.
Our
disagreement.
Our silence of consent.
Okay. I guess it is. Yes, that's right.
No disagreement.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. So, again, for our listeners, there are 15 articles in here. We're going to start by talking about Article 1, Sovereignty and the Declaration of Independence, and Article 4, Militias, Firearms, and the Second Amendment. So let me go over what most of these articles look like. There's usually an affirmation, a declaration of the facts, and or a resolution, and then there are general remedial instructions to Congress and each of the states, additional remedial instructions, and usually recommended civic actions by the people. Does any one of our guests tonight, would you, any of you, like to read the affirmation or discuss the background, or would you like me to do it, or what would you like to do?
Well, who has it in front of them?
I do.
Okay, why don't you read it? You have a more pleasant voice anyway.
Oh, John, I was going to say that about you too. Anyway, so here it is. This is the Sovereignty and Declaration of Independence, and A, it's an affirmation. We the people, in order to maintain our independence from any oppressor, to protect our rights as free men and women, to secure the blessings of liberty for our posterity, and to document our resolve to resist any external or internal force which may seek to curtail those rights, make this affirmation. And why we're talking about this right now is we've got, you know, our purported president over in Copenhagen ready to sign away certain things, and this is a declaration of resolve of the Continental Congress. Whereas all sovereignty originates with the Creator and is gifted to the individual, from where it is delegated to the family to the state to the nation, any corruption of this order violates natural law and the God-given rights of the people. And whereas all political power is inherent in the people, and whereas the rights of natural persons are inalienable, and any of those violations of these rights is cause for remuneration and or punishment. And whereas the purpose of government per our founding document, the Declaration of Independence, is to, quote, secure these rights, unquote. And whereas any government that becomes destructive of these rights has abused its authority. And whereas history has shown that the further away governments are removed from the people, the more corrupt and oppressive they become. And whereas officers of our governments have taken an oath or affirmation to support, defend, and defend the federal and, in some cases, state constitutions. Whereas the federal constitution is the supreme law of the land. And whereas there are certain unelected supernatural bodies, supranational bodies, which seek to place nations under their jurisdiction and authority, which are outside the scope and intent of the federal constitution. And whereas those types of organizations are incompatible with liberty, the founding ideal of the United States and each of the several states. And whereas the Declaration of Independence documents man's right to establish governments to secure his liberty and alter or abolish those which do not. And whereas the concept of judicial review of constitutionality is not to be found anywhere in the federal constitution. Whereas the 9th, 10th amendments to the federal constitution clearly indicate that all powers not enumerated in the constitution are reserved to the states or to the people. Whereas the states not ruling on constitutionality, it is the responsibility of the people to decide what is or is not constitutional. And whereas this body is made up of people who are able to instruct our servant government, whereas we the people do not consent to supranational bodies, which may or may not seek to become a world or even regional governing body, therefore be it resolved that we the people do hereby claim and ordain ourselves independent from all supranational bodies, including but not limited to the United Nations and any subsidiary of the International Monetary Fund, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, any so-called free trade treaties or organizations, the World Health Organization, groups which seek to subvert our constitution, such as the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, any treaties that infringe on our rights to self-governance and organizations they may create, and any others that may exist or arise. We also do not consent to tyranny. We reaffirm our unalienable rights. Be it further resolved that this body appeals to the people to secure their sovereignty by any and all means necessary. This body recognizes that if or when force is brought to bear on the people, it is the right of the people to meet that force with equal force, be it from a foreign body or misuse of domestic power. Be it further resolved that this affirmation serves as notice to any and all would-be oppressors that the people's resolve shall not be questioned, and no person or group has the right to exert their will upon another. The strength of our convictions is deep and powerful, and these are tested at great personal risk to our would-be oppressors and their employees. If this tyranny is brought to our doors, then the consequences will be brought to theirs. Now, I did cut down a lot of stuff. These words specifically are being edited now, so how I read it tonight might not exactly be the version you see, hopefully in a couple of days. But from that standpoint, guests, do you have any comment on this, and were you involved in these particular groups, and what do you think the significance of this declaration is right now?
This is Red Beckman. I was not a delegate, so Terry and the others, I think, were delegates, and so I will just kind of try to analyze what they're saying and probably make a comment after they've given their ideas as to what they've put together.
Terrific.
Okay, I was not on the committee that developed this particular part of the Articles of Freedom, so I've only coming into it afterwards. I do have some problems with it as worded. It's kind of feel-good rhetoric that doesn't really address any particular points of action.
Excuse me, I just read the affirmation. I didn't read the instructions to the Congress or states. If you'd like me to do that, I would, but otherwise, go ahead.
Yeah, it's as written, it's rather naive. Okay. The situation is much more complex than the wording we've just heard would suggest. And although it's all right for a kind of a, you know, action affirmation 101, if we got into it very far, we would have to clean it up quite a bit.
Well, okay. What? Let's pull that back. And Terry, could you comment without having been on, you know, on that committee, just what you feel the piece of this is? My understanding is, regardless of the wordiness and so forth, the sentiment is the need to stop giving away the sovereignty of the people through various means and to declare an independence from this new world order. And I don't know, again, perhaps you'd rather have me start reading the or going over what the instructions were from here. But would you like to comment a bit on that as well, Terry?
Well, frankly, I to some extent agree with John Rowe.
Well, I do too.
About this language. To me, it's the part of it that is good really is kind of just informing the general public that these conditions exist, because I don't think it's things that people are stopping to think about it. I'm sure that Red Beckman, if he were more familiar with what you just read, he would probably be making comments about these are the sort of things they need to be teaching in our schools if they were not government schools, and talking about in our churches if our pulpits weren't silenced by, you know, the bribe of the tax deduction. To me, it strikes me rather obvious that these are simply conditions that exist. And for these reasons, we need to take some action. I don't know really what more to say about this particular one than that.
Perhaps I could offer what I think would be a better statement of what it is that the authors of that statement are trying to get at.
Thank you. That would be terrific, John.
Okay. Now, this could get to be a very long dissertation, and I have written
about
it.
I extended the show because I knew you were on.
Yeah. First of all, there is not this notion of a new world order is a phrase that is used primarily to describe the situation in the world following the collapse of the Soviet Union. Okay. In other words, it's a state of affairs as they exist. It's not so much the name that the globalists or whatever you might choose to call them use for what they're trying to achieve. So I've been able to identify a particular name for that. They do seem to have a general objective, but that's not the phrase they use for it, and for us to use that phrase, it's sort of to miss the mark. Second of all, there's a general problem with identifying these international organizations as though they had a will and life of their own. In general, they don't. they are diplomatic assemblies of the nations of the world, various combinations, and they are nothing more than their members. They can do nothing by themselves. Yes, they have staffs and secretariats and, you know, bureaucrats and all that, but the reality is that it's not the Bush, it's the guys hiding behind the Bush that are important. And if we take aim at the Bush, you might get the Bush to burn, but you're not going to get the real targets. So when people talk about the CFR, Bilderbergs, or anything like that, that's really kind of missing the mark. I mean, I could join the CFR if I wanted to. All I got to do is just fill out an application form and send them a check. It's a professional association. And I don't have any particular interest in doing that because I don't have any particular interest in attending their meetings. But if I wanted to, I could. So could you. It's not a closed club. So what is actually taking place there? Well, is it something that's being done by the staffs or, you know, of the CFR? No. Is it done by the leading members of the CFR? Well, kind of. But by and large, you miss the point if you focus on what is essentially a kind of get-together. You know, anybody can get together. That doesn't mean much. It's what the people do who, behind the scenes, who sometimes get together, that's important. And that's the real thing that we need to be looking at. Now, that can get very complicated indeed, because what you have, and I've in the past, I've gotten to know a lot of these people. I spent 2 years in Washington hobnobbing with a lot of them. Of course, that's been a long time ago. That was the 70 to 72 time frame. And, yeah, I've kept up with a few of them since, but it's mostly a whole new crop. But, you know, the essence of what I saw when I was there hasn't changed that much. And what I found is that generally the world is run, if you could call it run, by a bunch of people whose main skill is developing contacts. In other words, they're social skills. They're not generally intellectual skills. You know, at the risk of sounding a little arrogant, which I sometimes do, I've attended a lot of meetings where the movers and shakers were in attendance, and I found no one in the room that really knew what they were doing as well as I did. And I was often called in to help them with things that they, because they couldn't do things, they lacked the skills, and yet they were intensely suspicious of me because they couldn't control me. And they were suspicious of almost anyone who was, you know, more talented than usual. So they not only are not the best and brightest, they don't even hire the best and brightest. And we can see that in the current debacle in the financial institutions. You would think that they hire the best and brightest mathematicians and economists. Well, they don't. I've gotten to know a lot of those guys, and they suffer from the same weaknesses as, you know, your shoe salesman or anybody else you might know in your ordinary life. They're fairly clever at very narrowly specialized tasks, but they turn off their thinking when the prospects of making lots of money looms before them. And suddenly all thought of risk, you know, disappears, and they're just like, you know, an adolescent at the gaming tables in Las Vegas. So, you know, these are the kind of people who run the world, and they get themselves and us into a lot of trouble. So, yes, there are conspiracies, sort of. I found a conspiracy in everywhere I looked when I was in D.C. But most of those plans don't work. The conspiracies don't work out because they don't know what they're doing. There's not some monolithic, committee of 300 or something like that that, you know, is moving and shaking the world. In a way, it would almost be a good thing if there were, because then at least somebody would be in charge who would, you know what he was doing, but there aren't. And that, in some ways, is a more frightening situation than a lot of the conspirators would have us imagine, because if the ship is being steered by a bunch of fools, you know, would you rather have it steered by an evil captain or by a bunch of fools? You know, you take your money and you take your choice. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid to say it's a bunch of fools.
So this, so in that context, thank you. This does appear to be naive in the sense of calling out those groups, because it is much deeper. Nevertheless, I think they're getting at some instructions when we are getting at some instructions, at least with this difficult subject, related to sovereignty, which basically, here are the instructions on page 5, which is to basically disallow Congress to surrender or delegate any portion of the sovereignty of the American people to anybody. And I recognize this language, or two, through some entangling alliance, special relationship, or other scheme of political or economic subservience to exercise any portion of that sovereignty in order to advance the special interests of any other nation, international organization, supranational establishment, or private organization of whatever sort. Do those strike you as, again, I also agree with you on the language, and I'm glad you clarified stuff, but do those strike you at even getting at what you consider what that issue is, John?
Some of them do. Mm-hmm. And let me develop that by going through the list a little bit. First of all, we the United States have not really surrendered our sovereignty to anything. In fact, what our position has always been, continues to be, under every administration, that we use international organizations as an extension of U.S. foreign policy. We view them as existing to serve our interests, and that's the way we do use them. But we make a few concessions here and there in minor ways, but we don't make any important concessions. Yes, we have entangling alliances, and yes, in principle, if, you know, Turkey invades Greece, we've got a problem because they're both in NATO, and we would kind of have to intervene on whichever one of them started it if we could figure that out. We've resolved that in the past by a couple of phone calls to, you know, tell them to cut it out. But by and large, there's more of a problem with the multinational corporations than there is with these international organizations. They have their problem with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank being two examples. They are a potential source of destabilizing the world economy. They've been trying to promote development, and they have mostly not been very good at it.
Right.
We have mainly used them as a tool for U.S. foreign policy, to try to stabilize various countries, especially during the Cold War, that we thought might otherwise fall victim to, you know, to Soviet expansion. Well, that's no longer an issue. Now we're more concerned about left of all countries that could become hotbeds for terrorism. And we look upon these international agencies as a way of preventing that, creating the conditions for, you know, creating which the original goal, and I've discussed this with some of the guys like the Rockefeller people and others, is essentially to create a universal middle class. Contrary to a lot of middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Contrary to a lot of conspiracy buffs, they don't really want a plantation world of, you know, a few rich people and a lot of poor people. They really do aspire to having a universal middle class. But that runs up against a lot of problems in a lot of countries. And what the United States mostly does is to try to use these international organizations, as I said, to serve our interests. And we pretty much only allow them to infringe on one another's sovereignty, not ours. You can see that in the European Union movement, which we have been, you know, facilitating behind the scenes. We are trying to get Europe to become one federal union like the United States, so that there's essentially one fewer decision maker in the world that can bring the entire system down by starting a nuclear war. So there's that kind of planning in view, but now we're faced with the prospects that any small group with enough money and expertise can acquire nuclear weapons and set them off in the cities of the more of countries like ours. So a lot of things are dominating our thinking. I'm in touch with the people in Washington and elsewhere who are desperately afraid of suitcase nukes being set off in our cities, and with good reason. I mean, they've actually approached me for my help in helping them solve the problem, which is an extraordinary thing for them to do, because normally they don't like to talk to me. But the fact that they would bring it up with me is indicative of the extent to which they are scared out of their wits. So they are riding the tiger of technological diffusion, as we sometimes call it. Technology can produce good things, but it can also produce weapons of mass destruction. And we are unfortunately moving toward an era when any disgruntled teenager in his basement cannot just plan to shoot up his high school, but plan to launch a plague that would wipe out the entire human race using commonly available materials that he can acquire through the Internet. The future prospects are quite grim, and it's easy for us to forget that, but a lot of these guys in D.C. and New York and Brussels and elsewhere are having to think about that, and they don't have any answers. They don't have a clue what to do about it.
Well, it's, you know, not unrelated to other things we're going to discuss tonight about our meddling in other countries' affairs at the great expense of the welfare of the people in the United States, which brings this kind of worry forward. I was going to ask you what kind of help you're going to give them, but I realized that was probably kind of a stupid question.
Yeah,
and
yeah, let me
but
just
the
make,
only
Yeah,
go ahead.
Make one final point. These movers and shakers are not essentially evil people. They at least think of themselves as good guys. Now, I'm inclined to think of them as fools, but, you know, for the by and large, although the judgment is often abysmally poor, they mostly have good intentions. So it's, you know, to attribute evil motives to them is not being entirely fair. Now, it's fair for some of them. I mean, okay, we got guys like Kim Il-sung and Ahmadinejad and a few other people in the world that, you know, they might even think of themselves as good guys, but it's pretty obvious from our perspective that they're not. But we need to find a solution that fits their vision as well as our own. And the one that I've always advanced is simply this, that the problems that confront humanity, whether it's seen by the elites or by seen by ordinary people, do not have a solution that does not involve a return to strict compliance with the Constitution, not just of this country, but of every country, although granted a few countries need better constitutions. You simply cannot solve these problems without mobilizing the full cooperation of the people. You can't do that in a political system, legal system, in which the people are at odds with their leaders. So the only way that we are going to be able to meet the challenges ahead is to restore strict constitutional compliance. Then and only then can we mobilize the people in the way that they would have to be to deal with these problems. To give you an example, what would we do if these guys smuggle 40 suitcase nukes into the United States and place them in various cities? The only way we could deal with a threat like that would be call up the entire population as militia to search every square inch of the country. And there's no way the people are going to do that unless they regain a sense of confidence in their leaders by having those leaders strictly comply with the Constitution. It just isn't going to happen. So, I mean, it's in the interest of the elites as well as ours that they wise up on this point. Because if they don't, if they keep trying to run the show by themselves, they're going to bring us all down.
Well, very excellent. Red, you've been listening there for a while. What do you think?
Well, I'm a little more of an optimist, I guess, than John. But, you know, I think that we have to find a beginning of something here that we a starting point. And I think the starting point has got to be that we, the people of this nation, we get off of our duffs and start getting ourselves informed, because every problem that we have in this country today, every problem, I don't care what it is, every problem is there because we, the people, have not been doing our job. We've been blaming the CFR. We've been blaming the Federal Reserve Bank. We've been blaming the elite and all, and we have not learned anything from history, and so therefore we're, falling all over ourselves, repeating history, some very bad history. Now, every generation, for thousands of years, every generation has always produced a small crop of people who are convinced that they are smarter than everybody else, and that they were supposed to be the boss. They were supposed to manipulate and manage people like cattle. And every generation has these people, and basically they're mental cases. They are mentally imbalanced, and you found a lot of that, some of it at least, you found some of it in the old monarchies. In the old monarchies, they would, the king's sons would be given special tutoring as they were growing up so that they would know how to act as kings and how to maintain control of the people. The founders of this country understood. We had some philosophers back there. John Locke was probably one of the most outstanding that tried their best to change the thinking of the people, the masses out there of people. And in my writing and such over the years and the books that I've put out, I've always tried to deal with the philosophical, because I think that that's where we're shortchanging ourselves. We were shortchanged, and we're shortchanging our posterity, because we're not teaching the principles of freedom and liberty. We're not teaching that. We tell the young people that they are free. And they hear this from the time that they're just small children until they're up in their adulthood. And you can talk to people on the street and just stop people and interview them a little bit. And you say, well, are you an American? Yes, I'm an American. Are you do you believe that you're free? And, oh, yes, I'm free. Well, do you are you afraid of the Internal Revenue Service? Oh, I'm scared to death of them people. Now, freedom and fear are two things that just absolutely don't mix. Water and oil don't mix, and freedom and fear don't mix. And so what we've got is people that have been so brain damaged that by the education system, where these we've had a certain number of these elite that have discovered what I'm talking about, that people, if you can control their minds, you can control the people. And you know, I've seen some pretty damning documents, copies of documents that were circulating back there in the 1920s, and I know that a lot of it was even prior to that, but I've actually seen some of this material where these people were trying to get more control of our education system in this country. And of course, Horace Mann came to the United States about 1835, 1840. And he was determined to establish public education in this country. And, of course, he was an avowed socialist. And so this has been going on for a long time. They don't mind at all if we point our finger at them you know, the CFRs and the trilaterals and the Bilderbergers. They don't mind a bit. That doesn't bother them at all, and because they know that they've got us in the palm of their hand, you might say, and so we've got to educate the people. And the problem I have with this document that you have is that there is no starting point there that points the finger right back at we the people. That we're the problem. It's not the CFR people. It's not the Bilderbergers and so on and so forth. The problem is us, because when we don't lead as we are, you see, our political system as it was designed with our Constitution for the United States of America. We the people were to be the leaders. We were to be the controllers. And we have lost that. And so there's a vacuum, and when you have that kind of a vacuum, you're going to have the elites come in and say, well, you people aren't smart enough to govern yourselves. So we have to do it for you. And so if we want to bring this back, we got to start with ourselves, and we got to point our finger at ourselves and say, hey, the problem is right here. And so, that's my view on this, and I've held this view for a long time, and I just... I'm just hoping that this window of opportunity that we have right now, where we've got millions of people in this country that are out of work, they're losing their homes, they're losing everything. And for the first time in my years of trying to wake up the American people, we have an opportunity. I joke about it. I say when people get out of work and a little hungry perhaps, or more than a little hungry, and they lose their property, lose their homes and everything, their hearing gets much better. And you can talk to them. You can explain things to them. And so we have that window of opportunity right now. And we... in this country had so much. We were given so much, and we built up a tremendous country, the greatest country that has ever, the greatest political law system that has ever been put together. And we were the envy of the world, and that's why we have so many people here from all over the world wanting to live here. But now we've got an out-migration of Americans. I know a party, he just come back from Panama, and telling me about all the Americans that are down there. And Uruguay, people that left Montana 5 years ago or so and moved to Panama, they have sold out at way more money than they had invested in property and such down there, and they're going to Uruguay. And so here we've got people in this country that have given up on the system, and that really grieves me. They should have stayed right here and helped us get back on track. But there's people out there. I'm convinced that the Continental Congress, I think that, as I said when I made my presentation there, and of course I've made no bones about it, I'm absolutely convinced that this federal government that we have today is going to be dissolved here in the very near future. I don't think it can be a matter of years before it happens. And when it happens, we're going to need leadership. And I was impressed by the delegates work until 2, 3, and 4 o'clock in the morning on their work. And they, as far as I was concerned, it looked to me like here was... here were people that were committed, they were concerned, and they were applying themselves, and that was very encouraging to me. And so with that, I'll probably have some more comment before we're done here, but I'll stop there.
Thank you, Red, very much. Terry, you've been there kind of quiet, too. Let's have your thoughts on this as well.
Well, if Red hadn't have been here, I could have said what he said, because you know, I look at these instructions and I see some of these things missing in this particular, not in all the articles, but just in this particular first article related to sovereignty. I said in the chat room a while ago that I think that some of these instructions have more teeth than they appear to have, but they also lack in specifics that would disallow or keep a usurper from worming around within these instructions. There's no question that we've got to make people recognize the concept of being lied to and get them to admit being addicted to it. As long as people are accepting the lies of tyrants and the propaganda and allowing our country and our children to be exposed to the subversion that is going on within our schools, from our pulpits, on the television set, in the movie theaters, all of the media. As long as people continue to accept these lies and not be willing to look past this and to dig deeper into it and to understand these principles of liberty, there's no way we're ever going to achieve any sovereignty unless we can raise up, that 5 to 10% of people that are willing to fight and to stand for the truth and not accept these lies. We've just got to get enough people with their eyes open and their hearts open and enough energy and courage to stand forth and to put a stop to this. And I don't really see the inspiration for that in this first article. I'm sorry. I wish I could say differently, because I really wish I was looking at that kind of inspiration, but I don't see it.
Thank you for all of that, all three of you, because as I look at the instructions now, aside from what I read earlier, the only thing was state sovereignty resolutions, but there wasn't even really anything that would make sense as to either what the larger issue is or what the practical actions might be down here on the ground. Because the sovereignty, and you also mentioned in the chat room, Terry, that the instruction should have been read all of Red Beckman's books and get educated. And John was also right there saying, until we have leadership that respects the Constitution and people who understand that we need to walk back this government, get it back to constitutional governance, that nothing's going to happen. We won't even know how to attack this issue of the sovereignty. I did want to ask all of you just on that sovereignty issue, because I think then, John, you had provided a great segue into the militia from what you were talking about in terms of the larger threats that we face. And I'd like to get there, because I know we wanted to talk about that tonight, but that works. But let me ask you, John, and perhaps Red and Terry, if you want to weigh in as well, in terms of these supranational bodies, but basically those who have the ability to destabilize our economy and the world economy and so forth, would you consider NAFTA a giveaway of sovereignty, so to speak, or more or less an entangling alliance, special relationship? And in that context, if NAFTA is the stepping stone to a North American currency, how do you feel about that, and any instructions, if you will, on what we need to do to deal with that, aside from totally repeal the law?
Well, NAFTA is a complex issue. I've studied it thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at it from different points of view, but the main thing that it did, which was positive, it eliminated import duties, tariffs, between especially the United States and Mexico. At the time that it was adopted, our import duties were, of course, the same for the whole rest of the world. So they weren't different for Mexico than they were for other countries. And they were very, very low. And most things didn't have a tariff on them at all. Whereas Mexico had very high tariffs on almost everything. So we had a situation, I used to be involved in this in a way, where we were essentially smuggling stuff into Mexico, okay? Because, you know, what Mexico had erected was an import industry of corrupt officials. You paid, you know, 50% in import duty and 200% in mordida. So the main thing that NAFTA did was reduce the opportunities for corrupt officials to take a bite. It did very little else that wouldn't have occurred anyway. All this talk about losing jobs to Mexico, well, no, not really. We would have lost them anyway, and we've mostly lost them to other countries. In fact, Mexico has lost jobs too, and they've lost them to the same other countries, namely China and South Korea and a few other countries like that. So you can't just single out NAFTA apart from the entire international trading system. And here's where we get to a point that needs to be understood. The prosperity of the United States since World War II has rested upon one primary foundation, and that is that our investments in science and technology occurred here more than they did anywhere else in the world. We developed new technology here, and for a while, we used the technology to maintain a trading advantage with the rest of the world and to create jobs here. But it's inevitable with technology. You can't pen it in. It's going to spread. It's going to diffuse, as we say, economists say. So you can pour the water in at the top of the hill, but it's going to run down into the valley. The only way you can stay ahead of game is to continue to invest in more and more new science and new technology. And we haven't been doing that. If we had, we wouldn't have a lot of these problems. So when Obama or others talks about creating jobs, the main kind of investment they should be talking about, although infrastructure doesn't necessarily hurt if it's the right kind, the main thing they should be talking about is investment in science and technology.
So this is a very good tool, I think, for people to use and for me to just extract here. In addition to a comment Tenacity just made in the chat room, which is really, if you're looking at people to vote for, at least just looking at elections right now, those are good clues. People who are going to talk about that kind of investment and able to do something about and making some plans. And secondly, not voting for, if you will, anyone who's associated with, quote, secret societies-type politicians, whether we go after those secret societies or not, but basically to try to begin to minimize the influence of any kind of external influence that will push our politicians to or enable them to basically subvert the Constitution by what they're doing.
Yeah, well, most of that involves simply personal relationships between people in positions of power or those surrounding them. It really comes down to that. It's what I said earlier about their chief skill being making contacts.
Right, right.
You know, when a CEO gets millions of dollars in wages and benefits to head a company, is it because his management skill is superior to that of all other contenders? Of course not. I used to work for Home Depot when Bob Nardelli was heading it, and he was, as a manager, a disaster. And yet now he goes on and becomes the CEO of another large organization. Why is that? Because he can make a phone call to Wall Street, and they'll take his call. because he knows them personally.
Yeah, it's just that this, when you think about the parallels with right now and, say, the New Deal, the FDR period, and even a period when Woodrow Wilson was around, it's this amazing shift of emphasis on, I guess, the state taking your alliance away from these quote-unquote quaint constitution and old loyalties that no longer work. And it seems to be associated with a certain kind of people. They always seem to come out of Columbia and Harvard. And, a certain class of people.
Actually, mostly Yale.
Okay, well, there you go. But anyway, so I think I get what you're saying about how these societies are difficult to get and that the people are really no more skilled than any of us except in certain areas of personal relationships. But candidates associated with that, I'm sure out of the 300 million people in the United States, there got to be a few who do not belong. And, you know, whether they can or not, at least that becomes some kind of, not exactly litmus test, but at least it becomes some kind of guidepost for, you know, what really is behind these people and their views. Even though they talk nice, they might really have another agenda, just like Obama. You know, we let go, but he talked nice, but basically now everyone knows what his agenda is. I mean, my goodness, it's completely different than, you know, what he said or what people voted on. So,
however, let's be fair to Obama. Most of what you're pointing to there, it comes more from his party than from him personally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if Obama were a libertarian, we wouldn't be having this conversation about him.
Mm-hmm.
And he could be doing many of the same things, but, you know, basically looking good and talking, making good speeches and, you know, turning on the Christmas tree and, you know, that sort of thing. So I would put much more of the blame for that on people like Pelosi and Reid and others in Congress who are desperately trying to buy more voters.
Mm-hmm.
They always feel insecure about their ability to win the next election.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, this government option, a public option as they like to call it, is their way of buying such a big chunk of voters that they can never again lose another election. It won't work, but they think of it that way. So they're running us into the ground, and Obama is basically just riding along, going along for the ride. I don't see him initiating most of this. Maybe if he took charge and did, we'd have a better situation. But right now, most of the initiative is coming from members of Congress, or more precisely, from the people behind those members of Congress.
Yeah, that's right. We've still got that shadow kind of government thing going on. Now, I'm going to take a break, but I'd like to just sort of wrap this piece up from our discussion of this first article. It's apparent that it's too broad and not specific. And Ashley, I agree with Terry that we should all just read Red Beckman's books and then we'll be fine. But it also, I think in looking at these things in front of me now, it also is about people retaining their personal sovereignty. Because if you don't understand that and what that means, how can you talk about your nation giving away sovereignty? It does start with us in a lot of ways.
Individuals are not really sovereign. That's a misuse of the term, as I pointed out in a recent post to Basecamp.
Mm-hmm.
And those who engage in the individual is sovereign type of arguments are really leading us astray.
Well, anyone have any comments on that?
I disagree with that.
Explain that, because
so do I.
Yeah.
Red, do I get to go first?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Let me let me jump in this one first, and you can correct me. Being a sovereign simply means you have the final say on the law. And who are jurors? Jurors are the people who have the final say on a law. The petit juror cannot be overturned by our president, not by the Supreme Court, not by any court. There is a final say on the law when you acquit. When somebody comes up and you judge a law and you say that's a bad law and you acquit those people, you have the final say on the law. And from that perspective, we are sovereign. Also, being a sovereign means, in this case, that we are above the Constitution. We created the Constitution,
right,
and we get our rights not from any government, but we get our rights from our Creator. And from that perspective, we are sovereign over our government in that we created it, and we have a right to judge the law. That is why we are sovereign. Now, Red, you can do it. Say your thing.
Well, you said that very well. The Seventh Amendment. I am convinced that the Seventh Amendment is the only place in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that really set us apart from the government. And that part where it says that in suits of common law, value and controversy exceeds $20, a right to trial by jury shall be preserved. But then it goes on, and this is where the power is in this, and it says, and no fact tried by a jury may be reexamined mm-hmm. by any court in the land. And that tells me that, you know, we on that jury, when we're sitting on that jury, and it can be only one person, this is one reason why I'm an optimist, because if we can put one out of 12 on every common law jury in this country, and these common law juries are coming, and they're going to happen, and one person out of 12, what is that percentage? You know, it's we don't even have to have 10%, you see. More like about 8 or 9. And percent of the people that understand this, and we can defend that Constitution, we can enforce that Constitution. One person on that jury, and that is what sovereignty is all about, is he who has the final say on the law.
Well, not quite. In legal theory, the sovereign is the supreme lawmaker. And when a juror refuses to convict, he's not making law, he's refusing to enforce a law. If there's a law involved in the case at all. And the nature of things is such that most laws are never going to go before a jury. They're enforced at the administrative level or they're enforced at other levels. They seldom, if ever, get to the jury trial stage.
Well, that's going to be corrected.
That
is going
to
be corrected.
Because
what?
People need to understand their rights to have those.
And get away from all these lawyers. That's the big thing.
Yes.
But
yes.
when the jury refuses to enforce a law, or it's more properly, probably they're refusing to obey an unconstitutional statute, and some might vaguely sense that it is unconstitutional, then that is indeed a critical role, but it's not lawmaking. And we still have the problem that lawmaking is a collective act. We are not individually lawmakers. I mentioned on base camp, well, there's a rhetorical sense in which we're sovereign over our own bodies, the space within our skin, but not outside of it. And to be sovereign in a meaningful sense, you have to have territory, more than just be your body. And about the only way you can have that now is to go to Mars or an asteroid or someplace like that. Because there's no place left on Earth.
I think on this issue, it probably deserves a lot more discussion, because there's some splitting hairs here. There's the issue of legality. There's the issue of our true sovereignty, and the sovereignty really resting within the people, that being enshrined within the Constitution and so forth, and the Declaration of Independence. We should have a discussion on that. But at this point, what I'd like to do is just take a short break, no more than a couple minutes, and then come back to how this would morph into, or basically why then the militia becomes important in this issue of not only understanding our sovereignty, but actually exercising it in our territories of our states, and how that is something that, in my view, is essential to movement forward, because there's a good educational component there. But if that's all right with you, we'll just go to a break. Please hang on the line. Get a soda, coffee, whatever it is, and we'll be back in just 2 minutes. Well, I hope you got up and maybe did a little dancing there or something.
I really
welcome back
with orange juice.
Very good. Okay. Do any of you feel like we should continue on the sovereignty piece or move right into Article 4 on the militia and the Second Amendment, or Article 4?
Well, let me say one thing on this. I once had a great English teacher who said, don't label, describe. The word sovereignty is a label. Most people don't have a clue what it means. It sounds impressive, but the use of the term can be a dangerous crutch for those who use it.
How would you describe it, John?
It would do a lot more good than just drop the word and try to replace it with description of what it is that we're trying to say.
Like, for example, the final say on the law as a juror.
Well, that's part of it, but also that since the whole thrust of the article is about international sovereignty, to be specific as to what it is that people are objecting to, not in vague general terms, but it's specifically we object to this specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you just waste your time and your readers' attention on vague things that neither the speaker nor the listener understands. So my recommendation in all of these matters is to don't label, describe, and be as specific as possible in your descriptions. You do that, you'll clarify your own thinking, and you'll be more likely to come up with action plans that will resonate with your audience.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, again, sorry to belabor this, but I'm hoping to get at what you're saying, John, but with respect to this first article, clarifying that by doing this particular action, this economy or the welfare of the country is impacted by this, this, and this way. And we believe that that is fundamentally giving up these various things that you're supposed to be doing to protect us. Instead, you're giving up things of ours to protect somebody else. Does that get anywhere closer to what you're saying?
Well, let's discuss it in terms of the kind of thing that is a real threat, in some sense, to our well-being in the international scene.
Mm-hmm.
Having multinational financial institutions that can bring down the world economy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, that's not ceding sovereignty to some international organization. That's ceding control of our economy to international corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a far, far more serious threat than joining the World Health Organization. Okay? Or having people, you know, collect donations for UNICEF on Halloween. Okay? You know, we have international financial institutions, and granted, most of them are headquartered in New York, but they are international, that can literally collapse the entire world economy, far worse than the Great Depression. This may still happen. We're not out of the woods yet on, you know, the efforts being made to avoid it, because it's based ultimately on a false premise, which is debt-based currency, the entire economy based on debt,
which is unbelievable.
If we really want to address threats to what might be called sovereignty in some sense, we need to address our willingness to allow this kind of situation to develop that could bring down our economy without us having any way to effectively prevent it. There's no law that we could pass, no regulatory agency we could establish that would prevent this system from bringing down our economy. Because 75% of it operates beyond our borders. And if we tried to regulate it, the other 25% would move outside our borders. So what are we going to do about that? Some would say that we need an international organization, some kind of a governing body to deal with international financial institutions. Well, in effect, we already have that. We have things like the International Bank of Settlements, which is key to the entire world monetary system. The Great Depression occurred not starting in 1929 with the stock market crash, but in 1931 with the collapse of the international monetary system. The international monetary system, then as now, depended entirely upon handshakes among leading world bankers.
Mm-hmm.
And when the political foundations for some of the bankers were eroded by things like the Smoot-Hawley tariff and things like that, then all of a sudden those handshakes ceased to be meaningful and it was every man for himself, with the result that was disaster for the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no effective way that we could prevent that from happening again, even if we did have a world government. If we don't address the fundamental problems of how we allow large organizations that are not accountable to anyone, including their own shareholders, to come into being and become too big to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And my solution to things like that is essentially to make every individual his own banker. The technology is basically here to do that. When you pick up your cell phone or even your credit card, it wouldn't just be a cell phone or a credit card. It would be a bank, your own bank, with all the functions of any other bank.
Gee, that sounds kind of sovereign to me.
Yeah, but the thing is that there would be no large institutions. All there would be was a bunch of transactions between individuals. Everybody's own bank, buying, making deposits, paying bills.
The way it sort of was. Yes.
Yeah. So now that wouldn't solve all problems. We would still have the problem of herd behavior. But we see that in the big financial institutions as well. I mean, this whole complex derivatives thing was herd behavior. They tried to outdo each other in coming up with ever more complex financial instruments that none of them was willing to admit that they didn't understand what they were doing. So the emperor had no clothes, and it took a collapse to show that he had no clothes. What we need to do then is, and it's going to be complicated, if we made every person his own banker, we would still have to have a way to randomize their business strategies. Now, that gets very complex, but what it essentially means is that you can't have everybody pursuing the same business strategy at the same time. You have to essentially compel people to randomly depart from what might seem to them to be a rational strategy, which means that people have to agree in advance to run the risk of losing everything in order to maintain a certain level of randomness in the way they make business decisions. Because what we learn in game theory is that optimal strategies in game theoretic situations, games, generally are random or have a random component. If you try to play a deterministic strategy, everybody loses.
Okay. Now, yes, thank you. And let's pull back from this just a little bit, because this is going to require another, a show devoted to this, I think. Because, again, we get back down to the individual. as the person, we the people who are going to move this country back to constitutional governance or reform the government as we need to. And so this then brings me to the second topic of our evening, which is militia firearms and the Second Amendment. It is Article 4 and of the Articles of Freedom. I don't think it's useful to go all the way through it except for a couple of points. But I'd like to first start this by asking Red, you've written so many books on this, and I am struck by really the way you're trying to help people understand that we've been scared to death of the militia because people have been bad-mouthing it, but why it is important, how it relates to our individual sovereignty, if you will, our individuals, and how that relates to essentially protecting a free state and a free state and its sovereignty. So, Red, if you could start, and then Terry, you were the lead on the Second Amendment discussion, so perhaps you could discuss some of the basic things that went into this and the exhilaration, frankly, when everybody agreed on the resolution of the Second Amendment group. So, Red, could you start, and I hope, you must have been saying this for decades, but I hope you don't mind indulging us one more time.
I'll tell you, there's one thing that we have to be very careful of, and that is we have to keep things down at a level that the American people can grasp. In other words, our conversation, our talk, our language, we have to, say things in a way that they can grasp, that they can comprehend. I was on a talk show with Irv Hallmer back in Baltimore or Philadelphia. I don't remember just where he was at, but he was a very well-known talk show host back there, Irv Hallmer. And we were getting along well with our talk show. This radio, it was a major daytime talk radio back there at that time. And somebody called in and says, you just simplify things. Red Beckman just simplifies things and all. And Irv Hallmer blew his stack. And he said, any damn fool can make things complex and difficult for people to understand. He said, what we need is people that can put it in simple terms because that's what people are asking for. That's what they want. And anybody can complicate things, but it takes somebody that can talk sense in a way that people can comprehend. And Irv said, well, Red Beckman is doing that. He's putting it into terms that people can understand. And, of course, the call-ins reflected that people really appreciated talked to in their language, you might say. And so this is one of the major things that we have to, work at. Cut down the verbiage and make it simple so that people can grasp what we're saying. And I was thinking of back in 76 when Jimmy Carter was running for the presidency and Gerald Ford was the opposition. And I seen this happen different times. Jimmy Carter would be in a debate or something, and he would say, trust me.
Huh?
And I thought, oh, my goodness, that should have sunk his ship right there. Because our system, our governmental system, cannot properly function on trust. It just cannot do that. And of course, Jimmy Carter proved that. And we were to be very, very vigilant and pay attention to what people are saying and what they're doing. We should have said, oh, wait a minute. We're not going to trust you. We're going to watch everything you do. And if you get out of line, we're going to let you know about it. And we put our trust in the Wall Street bankers. We were never informed, really, as to exactly how these people operate and what they were doing. And they didn't have our consent other than the fact that we didn't say anything. We didn't come out and say, hey, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. We don't trust you people. And of course, what we've got in plain layman's language back there in these international monetary scoundrels, it's a criminal syndicate. Now, you can talk criminal syndicate to anybody out on the street, and they know what you're talking about. But if you just talk about how they pull this off with the derivatives and all of that, they're not going to understand what you're talking about. And so this is what we have to try to do is get our message down in a language that people that have been shortchanged in their education process, they might have a high school diploma, a college degree, and all of that. But if everything that they learned was tainted with propaganda and bad misinformation, or you know, one kind or another, you're going to have to simplify it for them. And of course, if you get too much verbiage in there, you're going to turn them off. They're just going to go off and watch television. So I guess, and of course, and getting to the Second Amendment a little bit, you remember, Dr. Kate, we talked a little bit about how everybody's getting armed in this country. People that never owned a gun now own guns and ammunition. And what we have here is détente. Do you remember me saying that?
Yes, that's correct.
We have détente, and this is something that's in our favor. It's very simple. It's down to earth. It's that we the people's level. And this is going to stop this this train that's about to run us over. You know, it's going to stop. It's going to be painful. It's going to be painful what they've stolen from this country, our wealth and everything, what they have stolen. We're going to have to recover somehow, but I have a great deal of confidence in the working ability and the ambition and the innovation of ingenuity. These are all things that the American people are experts at, and that's what made this country great. So with that, I'll let somebody else talk.
Okay. Well, let me say something about the problem of these financial institutions, since we are still in a way. Alan Greenspan was shocked at what happened. It defeated his expectations of how the market is supposed to work. Now, it didn't defeat mine. I was expected it for a long time because I saw something that he didn't, which is that, see, what he was expecting is that the stakeholders, the shareholders of these organizations, and they do have shareholders, would supervise their managers in order to get their companies to make rational decisions. And that's what failed. The shareholders were content to receive their dividends, and as long as they received their dividends, they didn't care, look into what the managers were doing. This is a classic problem in which management can have interests which are at variance with the stakeholders. And for that matter, large enough organizations, each echelon of management can have interests which are similarly at odds with other levels of management, going all the way up and down the echelon. So that is a fundamental problem of large organizations.
Also, and we're still talking about people understanding not only their role, but also understanding this mess. Because if we're talking about shareholders not paying attention, the first thing that comes to mind for me is Americans not paying attention, not having the eternal vigilance to pay attention to let these kinds of things go forward. And that I still come back to and want to talk a little bit about how the militia and how the detente that Red spoke about is extremely important right now in both regaining the sense of ourselves, I guess, but also our responsibility to protect our communities and families. And for that, Terry, I wanted to have you weigh in on that issue of the militia, Second Amendment, and how it might relate to, you know, what we've been talking about now.
Kate, did you happen to see the report this morning about the lady? They played a 911 call where this lady was in her rural home there by herself, and a drug-crazed van came beating on her door trying to break in, and she's calling 911, literally begging them for 10 minutes to get there quickly because this man was fighting, you know, was trying to get through her door. And she did not want to kill this man, but she says, if he comes through that door, I'm not going to have any choice but to shoot him. And I'm praying that you will get here quickly. And while she was on the phone, he broke through the door and she shot him.
Wow.
Did you happen to see that or hear about it?
No.
Well, you know, I believe that there's a very, very good reason why the people, especially at Continental Congress, when the vote was strongly in favor of approving the report that our committee, the Second Amendment Committee, issued regarding militias, firearms, and Second Amendment, we put out I think that was a really good report. I'm very proud of the work that committee did. And when that vote came through and this report was accepted and the remedial instructions were adopted by the Congress, there were a lot of people in the hall and especially in the back that were literally in tears and hugging one another. Now, you don't normally think of that kind of reaction when you talk about militias and firearms, but why was that? Why that reaction? And I believe I have a good explanation of this. And it's because everything else to do with our liberty, with our freedom in this country, for what's made this country great, is, and I'm going to use the word sovereign, and I'm sorry for labeling it that way, but that's, I believe people understand it. The sovereign citizens of this country are armed to the teeth. And that is the one thing that stops this federal police state from coming in and literally oppressing us just like they would in Red China or any other place where their citizens are not really armed. I think that's the only thing that is saving us right now, because if you don't have a well-regulated militia or an armed citizenry, there's nothing to stop that drug-crazed or power-crazed person that's knocking at your door from coming through that door and taking everything you have, including your life.
I'd like to add to that. I've actually had conversations with people in elite circles who have frankly admitted that. One of them was a historian close to this, you know, those in power. who thinks that we would have become a fascist country after World War II had it not been for the armed citizenry. And he was in favor of gun control, okay? But he begrudgingly admitted that they did serve their purpose. And that purpose is primarily deterrence. Mm-hmm. The militia is achieved its main purpose when it doesn't have to shoot anyone.
Amen. Matter of fact, it's almost failed when it comes to that.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. Yeah, and, you know, I want to, for our listeners and for also our guests on the line, is that this was just that moment. I remember voting against certain pieces in the Second Amendment discussion because I didn't really understand it. But when that happened and we voted, I stood up and cheered like everybody else. And I was the one who, Ed Vallejo was, you know, crying, and it was just an unbelievable moment. And I remember something that struck me and will remain with me ever, forever, and that's when our president, Michael Bednarik, said, "This is what freedom is."
Yeah.
And
well,
it was that feeling. It was just unbelievable feeling.
Well, at the risk of letting us become too sentimental, I made the quip at one point during this session that, you know, I had had more people pat me on the back since I came to Continental Congress 2009 than in the previous 20 years. And that if anybody starts hugging me, I'm going to start to worry. because as I explained, this sort of thing only seems to happen to me at funerals.
That's very funny. That's very funny. So one of the things that struck me about the Second Amendment piece was that really all gun laws are unconstitutional, even open carry laws, any of them.
Yep.
And,
there were
you know,
a few that were back in 1792, a law that required everyone to have weapons and ammunition. That was constitutional. Laws that enhance the effectiveness of a militia to do its duty are constitutional. Anything that impairs it are not. I like to compare it to laws on the time, place, and manner of elections of members of Congress. As you know, the Constitution delegates to Congress a preemptive authority. The states have primary authority, but it has preemptive authority to regulate the time, place, and manner of congressional elections, except the place for electing senators. And some would argue, even, you know, in the legal academy, well, going back to Gibbons v. Ogden, that a delegation of authority is plenary within a sphere, to use the language from Ogden. But that's not true. In delegations of power in the Constitution are only for legitimate public purposes.
Mm-hmm.
They're always constrained by legitimate public purposes, by reasonableness, and which really means they're delegations of power only to exercise it in certain directions and not in others. So, for example, if Congress were to pass a statute requiring that everyone cast their votes within a one nanosecond time frame, or at a polling place on the moon, or for candidates on the ballot that were selected by, an election board in Washington, those would all be unconstitutional. Similarly, statutes that regulate militia to, let's say, require us to meet, to organize, to train, to equip ourselves, to, you know, use one caliber rather than another, so we're all using the same caliber, you know, to use a sniper rifle when you're on sniper duty and a shotgun when you're on sentry duty. These are reasonable regulations because they serve the effectiveness of militia. But everything else, the stuff that where it's being passed, is not passed for a legitimate public purpose.
Yes, and in this regard, and Terry, maybe you can help me here, and also Red, the militias were required. They're required in each state. The Constitution requires that under the Second Amendment. The militias, were required to have certain things like two horns of powder. I'm still trying to figure out how many bullets that meant. But in any case, we figured because of the misinformation and because of people making people scared of the militia, we defined it as a constitutional defense force. Terry, would you like to pop in on that one?
Well, I was watching the conversation in the chat room and I missed the last sentence you just asked me. I'm sorry.
Oh. Go ahead.
In my first book that I published in 1980, I made the statement that if you end up in a bloody revolution, a bloody revolution is the evidence of failure.
Yes.
Now, the failure can be from both sides. And you see, we don't want to fail. We the people, we don't want to be the one half of the failure. We don't want to do that. Now, what the Continental Congress has accomplished, and the Fully Informed Jury Association, the Tea Parties, there's just a mass of them out there. Everybody is confronting our public servants, our politicians and such. They're confronting them with our grievances. And with these articles that you people that were delegates to the Continental Congress, these articles, you see, they may seem like they're a little crude to some or missing the mark, but the message is there. We have a grievance. Now, if the government doesn't pay attention to what we're saying, if the Wall Street gangsters, the criminal syndicate, if they don't pay attention to what we're saying, if they continue to perform as they have, thumbing their nose at we the people, and we end up in a bloody revolution, a civil war, it is not going to be our fault. They are the ones who are failing. They are failing to pay attention to what we're saying. We've had enough of their dictatorial actions. We've had enough of their health care. We've had enough of all these no-win wars. We've had enough, and we're demanding that we have change. And if they don't change, I will absolutely guarantee that we're going to end up in a bloody civil war. I know that's what's going to happen because history proves that. And so, like I say, what the Continental Congress put together is a list of grievances. We're warning, we're telling the government, are giving them our position. And there is a lot more of us than there is of them. And they better listen. They better pay attention to what we're saying. because if there is a breakdown here and we end up in a nasty, bloody confrontation, it's not going to be our fault, because we have held up a standard, and we've told the government, come back under the law. As I have stated in the past, England, Magna Carta came into effect in 1215. Between 1215 AD and 1776, there was over 40 times that the people of England had to bring their government back under Magna Carta, back under the law. This is what we're trying to do, is bring our government back under the law that we the people wrote. It is the higher law than any statute or any treaty or anything that they made. The law we the people made is the higher law. And so we're telling them, we're giving them the warning, and if they don't clean up their act, it's going to be, the blame for this is going to be on their heads and their shoulders, not us. Now, I think I've said enough.
Well, let me give you a little bit of historical background.
Wait. Just let me squeeze this in between what we decided on. The term militia is inherently separate from the National Guard, and it means a constitutional defense force comprising all citizenry capable of bearing arms and under proper authority in defense of themselves and the state. I just wanted to get that in there because the militia is going to be very important as we move forward. Go ahead, John. Sorry.
Yeah. One of the key developments, I date this as one of the milestones in the March of Tyranny, was the Dick Act of 1903. And that is a very interesting historical background. Senator Dick introduced the act, creating what became, and with subsequent amendments to the act, the National Guard, essentially to eliminate the organized militia, to make it unorganized, most of it. The motive for that, as near as we can tell, and of course we have the evidence is a little bit thin, but we can try to fill in the blanks. That Senator Dick and his cohorts were concerned because Teddy Roosevelt had won the Spanish-American War with militia. Most of the people under his command, or that went to Cuba and, for that matter, went to the Philippines, were not regular troops. They were militia.
Oh, how did that happen?
And the powers that be at the time were concerned that if they followed through on what they were already making plans for the Federal Reserve and the income tax and also basically a kind of, you might say, economic coup, that if the people were still organized as militia, they would rise up and overthrow them. They were also concerned that somebody like Teddy Roosevelt, maybe even T.R. himself, might lead militia to Washington. So they wanted to nip the militia in the bud, and thus the Dick Act. And that had to occur before the Federal Reserve or the income tax or these other things took place.
Oh, that's interesting.
Now, as I say, the evidence is a little thin. You know, I don't want to stake my credentials as a historian on this chain, mm-hmm. but it makes more sense than anything else, and we can get fairly clear hints from what little debate there was on the bill when it was introduced. But it does illustrate that the hostility to militia is the same hostility that the elites have to the Constitution itself. because it represents a threat to their plans. And so, needless to say, they have made great efforts to try to stigmatize it.
When was the Dick Act?
1903.
Thank you.
Yeah, after the Oklahoma City bombing, when Oliver Buck Revell and others got on CNN and, you know, tried to blame the militia for the bombing, I conducted my own program of damage control, going to the various media and so forth with our side of the story. You probably don't remember, but Dateline NBC flew to Dallas to interview me on April 25th, episode of Dateline NBC opened with my voice saying, quote, "You have to ask, you know, we have to ask qui bono, who benefits," and then went on with an interview with me. Okay, when that happened, Washington went ballistic, according to former Senator Wallop of Wyoming, who is a sympathizer to our way of thinking, and he was in touch with people in Washington who, you know, and he reported that. So what was interesting about that is that all while I was going to the media, other people, blacks, what you might call them, PR people, were doing the same thing, trying to stigmatize the militia. It wasn't just Buck Revell on CNN. Okay, he was the front man for that kind of thing, but there were others behind the scenes literally going from city to city, media outlet to media outlet, talking to editors and so forth, not just putting out press releases. And there was one funny kind of episode that came out of that. Because I was tracking a lot of the same people. I was largely a one-man operation, and I think there were about half a dozen of the guys on the other side. And they weren't the best and brightest of Flax either. At one point, an assistant producer for a major media outlet that should remain nameless said to me, reporting to me about what her boss had said to one of these Flacks, "Well, Mr. Rowland of the militia movement has already talked to us about that, and his story is more convincing than yours."
Oh.
So it gives you a little bit of insight into what's been going on. For the elites, the militia provides a convenient scapegoat for blaming things. If anything goes wrong, like a bombing of a federal building, they want to be able to blame it on somebody.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, the militia has ceased to be a convenient target for that purpose, because now they have Muslim terrorists.
Excuse me, but we're going to have to end our show. 90 seconds is going. You can stay on and talk, but please join us tomorrow evening, same time, for Walls in Our Minds. Thank you very much, everyone. Excuse me, John, keep talking. Go ahead.
Okay, so having been in the thick of these things, I've gotten a kind of perspective on them that, you know, is priceless. You know, there's just no way to convey that kind of insight into what's been going on. It's a complex story, but an important one, because it does show what we're up against, but it also shows that now a lot of those same people that were stigmatizing militia have been turning to some of us for help in dealing with foreign terrorists. which is kind of amazing. We've been saying for years that militia was needed for to deal with such threats, and now they're finally beginning to come around to the idea that, you know, we might be right.
Wow. Well, this is very good. I'd like to continue this discussion next week, and our show has just ended. We're still live streaming, and just let me ask if Red or Terry have a last few words for this evening and the podcast.
Let Terry speak.
Well, the concept of the militia, you know, and I've said this before, maybe there's somebody listening tonight that hasn't heard it. The concept of militia is something much greater than the average person thinks of it as. It is a grassroots organization that starts right in your own precinct or your local community. And it is the place where people get to know each other and prepare for whatever is going to come, whether it's a catastrophe or a martial law or you know, whatever might threaten the community. That's and it involves all of the citizenry, not just those people that can be armed, because, you know, I even considered the butcher and the baker that stayed behind to provide the food for the militia to be part of that militia, the women who prepared and did all of the things that they did to take care of the home while the men were out fighting are part of the militia. And the militia is where you raise up your statesmen to run for office. It's where the relationships are built. It's where you create a rapport with your local sheriff. It's an information source. It's a lot of things that are important to the vitality of a community. And I just want to help people to understand that it is so important, because if Homeland Security tries to come into your territory, how else can you stop them at your border and say, we don't need you here, we've got our own backs covered, we've got our own situation covered, we don't need you here? How can you do that without a well-regulated militia?
Right.
So I just want
sure.
to get that point across.
Thank you. Well, gentlemen, this was terrific. Thank you, Red. Thank you, John. Thank you, Terry. We'll continue our discussion tomorrow evening. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank
K.
You.
Okay.
Night.
Talk with you soon.
Bye.
Night.
Good night.
All right.